I mean, a cop has to know that a drug kingpin isn't going to like being kidnapped and held for ransom. Especially this guy. I mean, he's kind of violent, right?
They drove to buy 100 kilos of cocaine. What they didn't know is they were stepping right into a DEA sting.
I said, you remember the last thing I told you last time we spoke? He said, yes, sir. I guess I'm under arrest now. And I said, yes, you are.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and executive producer of Fox's new America's Most Wanted. And Francie's not with me today, and I'm very saddened, actually. So I am carrying the torch of Best Case, Worst Case alone, but with my trusty companions, Matt and Josh. And we have two very special guests back again.
Hi, it's James Skip Sewell, former Deputy U.S. Marshal and DEA Special Agent.
And Keith Billiott, former Supervisory Special Agent. And we're going to continue with the tale of Ricardo Pena, New Orleans' single largest distributor of illicit narcotics to date. So last week we went through just a little bit of background here. We went through the fact that Ricardo Pena was the head of a transnational criminal organization that was just flooding the city of New Orleans with illicit narcotics, primarily cocaine, marijuana, and heroin, and how corrupt he was, and the folks that he surrounded himself with, how deadly these people were. Where we left off was in a hotel room in Houston, and there was actually a double homicide, a double murder being perpetrated. And I'm going to pitch it back to Skip and let him take it from there.
Yeah, I think we discussed a double homicide, but I think a little background on Pena is important. It was such a bizarre case. It's really hard to believe. I mean, I have a tough time believing it myself sometimes, and I was there. Wow. But Pena had many, many people working for him. He successfully recruited literally maybe 100 people that actually worked under his command. But probably the three most important were three New Orleans police officers. And wow. How he met these officers was one of the officers with a local New Orleans thug kidnapped him. They kidnapped Pena, the officer and the local thug, and held him for ransom. And the ransom was 10 kilos of coke and $100,000. Pena wasn't going to pay him at first, but he didn't have much of a choice. Pena's source, a guy named Fernando, was in town from Miami, and he was kidnapped also. The cop was going to kill both of them. The cop's name was David Singleton, and he is arguably probably the most corrupt police officer that ever wore a New Orleans police uniform. I believe Right now he's back in jail on other charges. But he kidnapped Pena and like I said, held him for ransom. Pena paid him. He didn't want to, but he paid him. And after he paid him, he made plans to kill him and the thug that was with him. But he believed the thug at the time was another New Orleans cop. It didn't wasn't until later on when he found out that the thug was a thug and not a cop. Well, he decided against it and eventually set up a meeting with Singleton and recruited him into his drug organization.
This I have to say, that's one of the most flagrant and dangerous things that a cop could ever do. I mean, a cop has to know that a drug kingpin isn't going to like being kidnapped and held for ransom. And that, especially this guy, I mean, he's kind of violent, right?
He's one of the most violent drug kingpins I've ever heard about, not just in New Orleans, but anywhere. But keep in mind, Singleton was nothing but a crook in uniform. He had been arrested in 91 for dealing drugs, but beat the charge at a federal trial, him and his partner, Raynard Smith. But they beat the charges at trial. But that only emboldened them, and they went out and started doing bigger and worse things.
Oh, unbelievable. So he recruited this cop, and then that cop got him two more? Is that what happened?
Well, one of the cops that worked with him and was eventually arrested was his brother, a guy named Ronald Singleton. But the other cop that did most of the stuff with Singleton was a guy named Raynard Smith. Raynard Smith would assist Singleton, and they kidnapped people for Pena. They would find out who was possibly cooperating with the government and pass that on to Pena. They did all kind of little odd jobs, but they did two kidnappings for Pena that ended up with the two suspects they kidnapped dead.
Wow. Well, these are really bad, bad people. Well, I'm glad they got brought to justice, I hope.
They did. They did. One of them got 15 years in jail. And the only reason he got 15 years in jail, Singleton, was because he testified against his former partner, Raynard Smith. Raynard Smith ended up getting life imprisonment for his role in Pena's organization.
But Singleton, you said, when he got out of the 15 years, he went back again
for dealing heroin. And I'm not talking about small amounts. I believe he had a couple pounds of it.
Mm, okay, great. Well, so let's talk about Pena. So how does this case progress and come to a close?
Well, let me tell you one of the events that happened with Pena early on. It was 1993, and Pena gathered up about $500,000 in cash. We got alerted that one of his girlfriends, a girl named Jeanette, was collecting the cash at a local hotel in New Orleans. We went out there and did surveillance, but we kind of missed her. I think we showed up when she was leaving, and then we, not knowing exactly what was going on, we heard that he was going to buy a big load of coke. That's all we knew. But, you know, we get tips like that quite a bit. So we kind of sporadically checked the hotel. And eventually, when the trash was discarded, we found all these money bands and rubber bands and ledgers where they were counting the money. We didn't know, but he was on his way to Houston. He had a compartment in a car built where he had $500,000 in cash. They drove to Houston to buy 100 kilos of cocaine. What they didn't know is they were stepping right into a DEA sting. Pena went over there with several people. And he was the only one to come back to New Orleans without handcuffs. He barely escaped. I don't know if it was intuition, what, but he would not meet the owners of the quote owners of the coke, which were actually DEA undercover agents and informants. And because of that, he barely escaped and avoided being arrested. And he made it back to New Orleans to start over and find another source and start dealing drugs again. Based on that, it's what's called a reverse undercover operation. When the cops pose as a seller to seize the money, it led to us eventually getting him a warrant on the reverse. So we had, it was later on, it was a couple of years later, we continued to investigate him, but that event there led to us eventually getting an arrest on him, the $500,000, just so we had that in case other things fell apart, which they didn't.
Awesome.
Was there once you guys discovered early on that there were cops on the payroll in Pena's organization, did that build distrust among the law enforcement folks who are working the case? Or were you guys pretty sure that everyone on your team was beyond reproach? I have to imagine when that sort of thing is revealed, all of a sudden, like, distrust starts to, you know, disseminate through the room.
To give you a little more context in a full flavor of what was going on within the city of New Orleans and New Orleans Police Department at the time, it wasn't just, so this investigation, which was huge, this investigation was ongoing, but there are lots of other investigations, narcotics investigations as well, including some of mine that were separate from this at the time. And it was unfortunately. It was not uncommon for us, and one of my Colombian investigations wasn't uncommon to actually watch New Orleans police officers in unmarked cars hand over bags of cash to Colombians in order that they would pay off our informants so that then we would give them the drugs. They thought that we were going to do them, as Skip was saying, in reverse situations. So, and along the lines of what Jim was just hinting at, that actually happened in one of my cases that took place during the same time period as the Pena investigation. And what happens is, to answer your questions with respect of how nervous it made us, we had a good idea of who the officer was that handed over that brown bag full of cash. It's a little over $30,000 at the time. In order to make sure that the word didn't get out and so that I could verify who it was, it took me two weeks, which would have taken all of 2 minutes if I'd been able to trust everyone at the New Orleans Police Department, pick up the phone, make a call. It took me 2 weeks to verify who it was. I get a warrant, a federal warrant through the U.S. Attorney's Office to arrest that officer, actually get the warrant signed. My partner picks up the warrant. He's coming back to the office. Now we're going to start making plans to effect the arrest. And I get a call from the number three at the United States Attorney's Office to please come see him, go over there and meet with him and find out, Keith, I've got good news and I've got bad news. Which do you want first? I was like, give me the bad news first. He's like, okay, you're never going to arrest Officer so-and-so. First thing he tells me, right? Second thing, I said, well, why is that? He says, because he's in WITSEC now. He's turned state's evidence in a major public corruption case. And then the so-called good news was, but I'll let you interview him, which was a total waste of time because the guy knew that he had his deal already made with the federal government. He told me nothing.
That was a better idea of
how extensive the corruption was during that time period.
Yeah, because obviously somebody told somebody who told somebody, and then he found out and he was able to get ahead of it. That's just horrible. But let's get back to the sting and, you know, the investigation and the arrest.
Okay. So now we have in our back pocket, we got the warrant for Pena if we want, based on the undercover reverse sting operation in Houston. But at the same time, and I'm fast forwarding, there's a multitude of murders and other things, but I'll fast forward to a point where DEA was on a wiretap on a guy named Aaron. The FBI at the same time was on a wiretap on a guy that was also getting his drugs from Pena. And both of them were very good wiretaps. And the FBI wiretap, Heather, the girlfriend that was in the hotel in Houston, they captured her making drugs transactions, arranging to pick up money, dropping off drugs, all kind of stuff. Same thing happened with the DEA wiretap. One of Pena's other guys, a guy named Jorge, who was also in the Houston hotel room, he was calling this guy Aaron, and the same thing, making arrangements to drop off money, making arrangements to pick up money, making arrangements to drop off drugs, everything. So the wiretaps were really going really, really well. A coordinated takedown took place. And this is in, I guess this is it's late 2000, no, I'm sorry, late 1996 and early 1997. And we do search warrants at six or eight different places. The girl Heather's house, all the places the FBI was watching on the West Bank of Louisiana from their wiretap. And we also later on did it on Aaron's house. A lot of money was seized. Some drugs were seized, but no Pena. Pena was still nowhere to be found.
Slippery dude.
Very slippery.
The ghost.
The Cuban was the ghost. And so things started to unravel for Pena when Aaron came in. Aaron started telling us about the organization, Pena's organization, started talking about murders he was involved in, gave us quite a bit of information about him. Aaron had prior arrest records, so Aaron wasn't getting out of jail. He was detained without bond. So what did Pena do next? He did the best thing. Since he couldn't get to Aaron, he got to Aaron's girlfriend. Aaron's girlfriend was a girl named Robin Petrie. Going to school, she was back living at home with her parents. One night, she came home late from school, and she passes a marked New Orleans police car on her street. She pulls into her driveway, gets out, and goes to the back to get a book bag out when two thugs from across the street cross the street, guns blaring, and shoot her 9 times and kill her.
Jeez.
This to send a message to Aaron about cooperating. The cop in the police car happened to be none other than David Singleton, who was waiting for the hit to take place and parked down the road. He pulls up and he does the preliminary investigation. I guess you can call it an investigation. He was there to make sure it wasn't solved and to do what he could to mess up the crime scene than he was to do any type of investigation. He interviewed a neighbor who told him about a car leaving with a broken taillight. It was the hitman's car. We know it because we know who the hitman was. He called Pena afterwards and told him to make sure they get that taillight fixed and put that car up because witnesses had seen it. And Not only had he been the first one to respond to the scene, but he was responsible through some of his contacts with Pena of finding out where this girl Robin lived, so that they could murder her to send a message to shut up Aaron.
Wow. That's just heinous stuff. Heinous. All right. So tell me, how did you eventually get him?
So what happened was we had the arrest warrant for Pena. We went ahead and put it into the system and let's just get him in jail, get him in custody. Now he knows at this point that we've hit all these houses. The FBI's hit houses, the DA's hit houses. People are starting, his walls are closing in. He had like 1,800 pounds of weed that was seized in a tractor trailer. Everything was just starting to crumble. We put the warrant in, and I used to be a U.S. Marshal, so I talked with a buddy of mine at the U.S. Marshals, and, you know, they hunt fugitives, and they're pretty good at it, and they could give a lot more time to it than us at DEA could, or probably the FBI, even though this was a major, major player. At the time, we didn't know to what extent, but FBI and DEA just weren't going to put all these resources in the hunt of one fugitive. Pena finally showed up on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. By this time, his wife had left him, and she was living under assumed name in Florida. But she decided to come back to the Gulf Coast to meet him for a weekend. Well, at the time, we had this technology, which back then, we're talking about the age of beepers. And when we knew his beeper number, we got a hold of his beeper number through all the different warrants and all the investigations. We had a couple warrant beeper numbers. And we put this device on it where if someone beeped it and he called back, you could find out where the location. It wasn't specifically where it was, but it'd give you a general area. Well, ultimately, we got a location of a place. It was a hotel in Gulfport, Mississippi. So we went over there. Before we could get there, the marshals and DEA went to this Holiday Inn where Pena was. It just so happens when they were pulling in, Pena was pulling out with his wife. He sees the marshals. You know, everybody always says you can tell a police officer, and I guess they can because he took off. The marshals and DEA end up going up to the room that he was in. When they got up there, they still had clothes and a couple duffel bags. Inside one of the duffel bags was about $500,000 in cash.
Wow.
They did it on exigent circumstances. So it was something that we were going to have to fight down the line as far as in court, the reason they did it. But they in there was $500,000 cash. Knowing that he would probably come back to get that cash, surveillance was set up at the Holiday Inn. He didn't come back. He's smarter than that. But what he did do is he sent his brother back and two other Hispanic-looking guys that were kind of out of place looking, who were surveilling the hotel and trying to see, they were trying to watch to see if we were watching them.
Right.
We didn't know who they were at the time, but we, on a hunch, followed them back to another hotel that wasn't too far from there, a little hotel in Diamond Head, Mississippi. The hotel clerk, she verified that the name the hotel was rented under was one of the alias names that Richard Pena and his wife Amy had developed through the years. They had, like I said, many fake IDs, many fake credit cards, all kinds of stuff. And so, anyways, the room was hit. We arrested like five people inside the room, and Pena said, "Do you know who I am?" He says, "You put me out on the street, make me an agent, I'll get you 1,000 kilos of coke right now." Well, of course, he wasn't going anywhere but straight to jail. Mm. His reign of terror, we thought, was over at that point until he gets locked down in jail. And he wasn't going to be kept in jail. About a week into his confinement, he had paid some prisoners to cut out some cinder blocks at the jail. He had someone waiting on the outside to pick him up. Well, it just so happened one of the prisoners in there was a DEA informant. And when they started cutting the cinder blocks, he called his handler in the Mississippi office, and the DEA task force rushed over and thwarted the escape attempt.
Wow.
That wasn't even the end of it. He even when he got back to New Orleans jail, he was locked down. He tried to talk his wife into bringing a gun into jail. That didn't work. He ends up confiding in this private investigator that's working for him that he's going to break out of the jail. He's got people that are going to hijack the U.S. Marshal van on the way to court. And he's got this long manifesto about how he's going to kill people that turned against him. It turned into defendant informants and snitches. And he's going to kill all these people, including the assistant U.S. attorney, a guy named Mike Walther, that was prosecuting the case. Well, that part got thwarted also because a private investigator turned him into us. And I believe it was the U.S. Marshals and FBI and some DEAs. Keith and I weren't allowed to because we were part of the other investigation. And this was a new charge, an escape. They went down there and tossed his jail cell. And sure enough, they found a bunch of information on stuff that he was going to do.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Well, Keith, how did you get involved in all that?
You know, as I said, I was all along, in addition to assisting Skip, I was working some other investigations. And one of those had to do with a guy named Pablo Pastrana. So long about the time that Skip is talking about, after we actually had Pena in custody, Skip decides, okay, hey, we're gonna go arrest all of his minions now. Well, one of those guys was Pastrana. So I'd been targeting Pastrana for probably 2 years, maybe closer to 3 years, but I didn't have what Skip had in his investigation, which was a good cadre of informants. I didn't have enough PC to get up on a Title III wiretap, that sort of thing. But I did a lot of surveillance on the guy. And at one point, I had told him, stopped him actually at the airport, and told him, pat him down. We searched him. We thought for sure they had money. They didn't have any. They were kind of laughing at us, you know, he and his brother, and thought they were going to have the last laugh. And I didn't get mad, took it in stride. But I went up to Pablo and smiled in his face and said, Pablo, take a good look. Look at me. Okay, look at me. And he says, okay. I said, I want you to remember this face, because the next time you see me, I'm going to be coming to arrest you. So as it turns out, Pablo gets caught up in the Pena investigation. Skip's working. So Skip, of course, gives me that guy. He says, hey, you can have Pablo. You go arrest him, right? So Pablo was a dangerous guy, too. This is the guy, I'll take you back shortly, but this is the guy who was dealing directly with Amado Carrillo Fuentes, one of the guys, the biggest Mexican trafficker of his age at the time. Mm-hmm. So Amado had all sorts of weapons, and instead of hitting the house hard and being worried about, he had a street sweeper shotgun, he had AK-47s and all this, we figured we'd pull a ruse on the guy. So I got some local deputies to go up in uniform, knock on his door. I was up on the front porch too. This is way before the time of doorbell cameras, right? And the locals knock on the door, and he comes to the door. He was actually in a bathrobe, comes to the door. And so the uniforms say, sir, very sorry to bother you, but his truck was parked out on the street. Pretty sure that your truck just got hit. Somebody sideswiped it. Would you mind coming out, take a look at it, verify it, and then, you know, we'll try to catch the perpetrator. So the guy starts cussing. He steps out onto the porch. I'm to the side. I step forward and I say, hey, Pablo, remember me? And he goes, I said, you do remember me, right? Right? And he says, yes, sir. I said, you remember the last thing I told you last time we spoke? He said, yes, sir. I guess I'm under arrest now. And I said, yes, you are. Turn around, put your hands behind your back. But at any rate, so I was doing those sorts of things, still running other investigations that had to do. We didn't target New Orleans police officers, but it had same things, corruption and all this sort of thing. So anyway, we hooked up Pablo. And then from there, I'm going to kick it back to Skip, and he can take us into this very significant now, Pena. Literally, you know, Jim, we have to make the motions through the assistant the U.S. Attorney's office to get the death penalty possibility actually enabled. And so I'll let Skip explain all that and what happens in the long run.
So Pena's in jail, and we start arresting all his people. I mean, arrest after arrest, warrant after warrant. But back to Pablo real quick. Well, we didn't know Pablo was in Gulfport, Mississippi at the time when we arrested Pena. Earlier that day of his arrest, Pablo had loaded $3.4 million into Pena's van. We didn't know about the van. We were happy with the $500,000. That van was eventually picked up by three rednecks from Slidell, Louisiana, who took it back to their shop. Believing that there was marijuana in the van, it was one of the conversion vans. They started cutting with a skill saw into the top of it, thinking that they had enough weed to get high for another year. When they pulled it down, all the money fell on them.
Oh, wow.
They started buying Corvettes and jet skis and all kind of stuff.
Really? Very low key, so nobody actually drew any attention to them, right?
Yeah, stuff where nobody would have a clue. And
Skip, I feel like this is rule number one of being a criminal. You know, like, you don't do that. I've seen enough TV shows to know that you shouldn't do that.
These are three rednecks that didn't know any better. They literally were. They were doing a favor for someone, but knowing that Pablo and everybody else is locked up, not knowing who this belonged to, had they known it belonged to Pena and ultimately Amado Carrillo Fuentes, who was coming looking for his money,
wow,
I doubt they would have spent it.
Wow.
But yeah, eventually we recovered most of the money. Some of it's still out there, but I told you, for the next 2 years, I drove a brand new Corvette. Compliments of them.
You seized it, right?
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
All right. So Because I don't want to hear about you taking a Corvette. That sounds like what that Singleton clown would have done.
Yeah,
man.
I'm glad you said seized.
Yeah. So all right. So I'm assuming that you go to trial. Does Pena plead guilty? He sounds like a guy that's not going to lay down and then give up.
Here's what happens. You're right about that. So all these defendants start coming in, and it's overwhelming at this point. Jim's gone. He's moved for safety. I'm over at the U.S. Attorney's office literally 12, 14 hours a day. I got people calling, hey, you know the murder that happened at such and such place? Well, Pena's people were behind it. You know this murder. Hey, do you know about the kidnapping? You know the body that was found out in the woods? The cops were responsible for that. And it's just overwhelming. Mm. Pena isn't going to go down without a fight. He says he's going to trial. At that point, it was Janet Reno. We did the death penalty memo, and she approved for us to pursue the death penalty on Pena. At the time, Eddie Jordan was the U.S. attorney in New Orleans. And after a long, drawn-out process where many of his people pled guilty, but we were gearing up for probably the biggest trial, corruption, murder trial in New Orleans. And Eddie Jordan talked to his lawyer, Pena's lawyers, and they eventually agreed that if we took the death penalty off the table, he would plead to life without the possibility of release. In other words, he can never get out of jail. And that's what he ended up doing. Now, to me, if anyone ever deserved the death penalty, it was him. I mean, he was behind a special needs kid getting killed, multiple different murders. He didn't pull the trigger in all of them, but he single-handedly, I think, was responsible for making New Orleans the murder capital of the United States in the 90s.
Wow. So I understand why that would justify it.
Jim, if I could. So just to give it some context that we knew of, there were at least 14 homicides, 14 murders. And as Skip said, they were done in just unbelievably arrogant, blatant manners, and a lot of torture too. You know, sometimes he would torture these people for 2, 3, 4 days before he murdered them. But at least 14 that we were aware of, 8. When Pena pled, he didn't just plead to, you know, okay, I killed a few people. He pled to 8 murders, but we felt like we could have proven 14 if we had to.
Wow.
And there were, you know, there were with respect to the corruption issues too. So 3 New Orleans police officers pled guilty, but there were lots of other police officers, and some of them weren't all New Orleans police officers, that were implicated in being part of Pena's ring. We just, there was only so many agents, and it was primarily just Skip and I, and so much going on. In addition to that, we just couldn't, we just had to wrap it up. You know, we just couldn't chase down every rabbit down every hole, but it was a very extensive organization.
Wow.
And keep in mind when the murders that he wasn't directly responsible for, you know, one drug, when he took over the projects, all of them in New Orleans, basically, they don't just automatically give up their turf, Jim, as you know. You got to take that turf, and that means by the gun. And right. So one dealer is just going to move aside so another dealer can come in and take his money and take his turf. So the gun battles, they never ending in New Orleans in the 90s.
Yeah, and you would think that would have been sort of a deterrent to cops kidnapping the guy who started all that in motion, started all that murder in motion. It's such a bizarre thing that not only did they do that, but that Pena decided that instead of killing them, he was going to bring them onto his team. Again, just a very bizarre and crazy case. But he avoided the death penalty and he got sentenced to life without the possibility of parole.
Yeah, he's in Beaumont, Texas right now. And I know you're going to believe this is strange, but I talked to him on the phone not too long ago.
Really? Wanted to wish him a happy birthday or?
No, I didn't quite do that. Every once in a while, in a weird, bizarre type of way, you know, you arrest people, they stay in touch with you. I'm retired now, but occasionally I'll get a call. Like I said, from Pena's hitman calls me every once in a while. It's weird. It's bizarre. I don't expect most people to understand it. But Pena's wife, I'd talk to her every once in a while, and she arranged, you know, he'd probably like to talk to you. And so we had maybe a 15-minute conversation about what he was doing.
about what he was doing in prison?
About what he was doing. And coincidentally enough, I think he wrote a couple screenplays and books, but they, of all things, I think some of it had to do with children's books. Mm. But here's a guy that when the judge sentenced him, showed no remorse. He said, "Judge, I love what I did. I love my job. I'd do it all over again." He said, "But also, I love this country. I'm glad I became a citizen. I would fight for this country if I was asked to." In a bizarre rant during his sentencing.
Guess what? We don't want you. Sorry. Sorry. Come on. You have to. It's an honor to be in the U.S. military and in law enforcement. And somebody like that, who's just, you know, a despicable human being, doesn't belong anywhere near our armed forces or our law enforcement.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's a crazy, crazy wild ride. I don't know how you put it all together. I mean, this guy was all over the place, and he was able to really prevent a lot of the investigation that would have been done from happening. And, you know, so just the fact that you were able to get him after all that was quite an accomplishment. And his minions.
I believe all total, 36, maybe 38 people went to jail behind this. A lot of his members of his own family, and probably some of the biggest gang leaders of all the projects in New Orleans. Several women that he had counting money and doing stuff also went. Millions and millions of dollars of property. He had, we found in his house in Florida, a diagram of a house that he was going to build on the beach because he wanted to retire, and he was close to it before we caught him. He had enough money too. And this was a 3-story house on the beach. It had it equipped with an elevator and just an elaborate house that he was going to build where his wife was living under assumed name. And then he also had a piece of property in the Dominican Republic that he wanted to go back to on the ocean that he was going to build there also. But, you know, we seize that property. We seize luxury car after luxury car from them, jewelry, just like, again, millions and millions of dollars in assets.
Well, that's awesome that you were able to do that and help, you know, defray some of the cost of this, you know, massive investigation. So I have to ask you, the final question is, was this a best case or a worst case, and how it affected each of you?
Well, I'll start with the worst case first. And what I mean by that is Pena started as a bus washer for Greyhound in 1988-89. And by 97, he was a multi-millionaire that ran the whole city. There were many times where we got close to arresting this guy, but we just didn't get him. I don't know if we put enough resources into it. You know, you keep in mind that there's a lot of other stuff going on. You can't just spend all your time on one guy, although maybe in hindsight we should have. But it was the best case because it all ended well. The agent, friend of mine in Keys, didn't get murdered. And we ultimately put all the bad guys in jail. I think 4 or 5 of them went to jail for life. And I think that at the end, it turned out to be the best possible case it could.
All right. Keith?
I think Skip is correct. Not the horrible things notwithstanding. So part of his legacy, Pena's, that is, unfortunately, is you had a whole new crop of hitmen that came up within the various gangs that ran the various projects in New Orleans. The amount of bloodshed, which was just unforeseen prior, and so in a very real sense, it created a lot of the violence then that kept going for about. We wound up working that violence for the next, I didn't leave New Orleans. My first assignment away was in December of 98. And when I left, Skip was still working drug-related homicides in New Orleans. I mean, because it just, it normalized in a very sick way, extreme violence. But I agree with him that it was the best case because it was, Pena was a true kingpin of what we now call a transnational criminal organization that had so much reach and had tentacles into everything. And it, mind you, it wasn't just, it was New Orleans-centric, but as Skip mentioned, he had properties and he was distributing in Florida, same thing in Texas. I mean, it was a regional juggernaut. So to take that out and to take out, I would say conservatively, Skip, his case was probably responsible for at least three quarters, maybe seven eighths of his entire organization being dismantled and put in prison. That was an amazing accomplishment. And I'm very, very proud of the work Bravo. That we did on that case.
Bravo. And that is great. And that's how we like to do it on the federal side, not just deal with, you know, what's obvious on the street, but actually try to take down the entire organization. You guys did a great job and we thank you for your service. And I'm sure that something you didn't mention, but I'm sure it's a reality that Pena was that much of a bad guy and he had his basically claws into law enforcement so deep that, you know, your lives were probably at risk during this process. And if he could have, he probably would have taken you out.
You know, it's funny you say that when you were talking about it earlier. A New Orleans policeman, and it wasn't so much Pena, although it was, but a New Orleans policeman told me one time, Skip, I wouldn't be called driving around New Orleans at nighttime. I had been involved in the arrest of a couple of officers, and I had served target letters to a couple more officers. Target letters are letting them know that they are the target of a federal investigation. And a New Orleans policeman approached me one time, good friend of Keith and mine. He says, Skip, I wouldn't drive in New Orleans at nighttime.
Wow.
Yeah, and I'd second that and just remind you that, remind the audience that this guy absolutely intended to murder Jim Holland and his entire family. It wasn't just Jim. I mean, this guy was ruthless. And it was certainly a time in which, as I said, I took 2 weeks, what should have taken me 2 minutes to determine the identity of a specific officer, because it was that precarious for us at the time. We just really didn't know, other than the people that we worked with that were with us, task force agents that were with us day in and day out, we really didn't know who we could trust at that point, Jim.
Wow. Well, that's a sad day for law enforcement and the community, but I'm glad that the bad guys were brought to justice, and hopefully that will deter anybody else who had that kind of a leaning to avoid that in the future. But I just want to thank you, and I'm sure Francie does, for being here and for the work you did. And thank you for bringing our listeners behind police lines and teaching them how complicated and difficult and long-term these major narcotics investigations are. Narcotics/homicide investigations are. So thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot, guys. We appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Well, till next time, everyone, thank you for listening to Best Case, Worst Case. Signing out.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production produced by Francie Hakes, Josh Murphy, and Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Matt Gerbel. Music composed and performed by Simba Sumba and hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness Delight can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's d2l.org.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.